darkly splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Thelema, exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. Last time, Edward Mason and I discussed the subject of Kenneth Grant and the so-called False Sephira of Da'ath. Rather than coming to a strict end, our conversation flowered out into a fractal proliferation of further knowledge on the subject.
Crowley loved to be over the top. Mm-hmm. The instructions for people coming into AA are quite strict and extreme. No other order has the same requirements, but it's like you have to be prepared to do everything here. An hour of pranayama. Really? A whole 60 minutes? Yes, an hour of pranayama. Oh, and you have to learn this and that and absorb a huge amount of information. But he understood it's only by pushing people to the extreme that they can begin to really comprehend things that are outside of our current mainstream. Mm-hmm. So we've discussed everything that's happening on the planet right now in 5 minutes or less. I'm not going to claim that I have done anything more than the occasional invocation of Saturn by usual planetary hexagram means to get some idea of what Bina is like. It's kind of interesting. It's very slow up there. You're not really in regular time. That is more or less what my entire experience, direct experience of Bina. Even less so with Chokmah, because there is that tremendous outpouring of high-level energy. It's almost impossible to do an invocation of Chokmah because you are trying to, it's like, you know, turning a telescope on the sun to see the sunspots, yeah. Burn out your retinas. It doesn't work. But what I understand is that you have gone, if you have done this abyssal crossing, it's quite a long time. As I said, Crowley needed a year, according to his own account, to stabilize as a master of the temple. And there he's had this sort of universal vision, which is way beyond anything, you know, any of us actually has. We have universal ideas all the time, but actually having the experience of being in that universality is completely beyond anything we've been through, and trying to imagine it just fills you with more ideas, which of course is what Da'ath is. It means knowledge. It's more information. Mm-hmm. So you up by not simply accepting what is there. You've gone then into this, you know, supernal darkness. It's all very, you know, there's an absence of light, at least initially. It seems that the contact with the Holy Guardian Angel is renewed at a certain point, but on a much expanded scale. Then there is this, what's Chokmah about? Because then you're going over into light again, which seems to be also entirely done on the level of Neshama. So I can't imagine what it is like, but maybe if we all sort of, you know, focus our minds on what it would be like to be not ourselves, but something beyond us, you'd be kind of aware of a process happening. If you think of Liber 65, there's a lot of passages in there where there's the scribe, which is Crowley writing stuff down. There's Adonai, which is the Holy Guardian Angel. There's the Magister, VVVVV, and there's also the Magician. They're all different levels of the same individuality, ultimately, which is this person, Aleister Crowley, Perdia Rabo, you know, with all the different names he has, Great Beast, and so on. But he's aware, the scribe, that there's this thing happening on a very high level that he kind of intuitively understands, in that the exalted state, when Crowley actually pulled through that text and some of the other holy books, it was being translated into semi-intelligible symbolism, for which he then had to produce a commentary, because most of us read the thing and go, huh? And it takes quite a while to get into the feel of Liber 65. But the effort is well worth it. So the Neshama is then flooded with a light that is transcendent, but it's able to appreciate what is happening. So far as I can understand, it's like the person, if we can still call them that, has gone over the path of Daleth into Chokmah from Bina. And of course, I guess at this point, the paths of Zayin and Hay, the lovers, and Nui, the star, are active as well. That means that there is a much greater level of illumination. The ordeal for the Magus is outlined in Liber B. Vel Magi, which is where, you know, there's a curse of the grade. Yes, you absolutely have access to this incredible amount of cosmic light and information, but there's a task to be done, which is to narrow it all back down and teach, knowing that everything you say is only slightly true. It's just means of getting people to the point where they can make some progress for themselves and eventually steer their own boat through all of this really strange stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what I have been given to understand. As I say, I'm not claiming any personal acquaintance with the experience, but the way it was described to me stayed with me, and I thought, okay, that's interesting to know, and it gives me a bit more of a framework to understand why I'm stuck where I am, because I still have an awful lot of things to get completed in my own career with this material. But you can understand that this is something that goes beyond what people who are dealing directly and solely with the inherited Golden Dawn material are dealing with. It doesn't take them up that far. There are references to these Sephiroth, and everyone learns the Tree of Life right away the moment they become a 0 = 0 in a Golden Dawn style order. Mm-hmm. By that, I include the BOTA and all of the Paul Foster Case line groups. So I'm reluctant to sort of stick that Black Brothers label on people who simply are doing their best to get as far as they can. At the same time, while I was considering all of this, I thought I wouldn't want to go to the Kenneth Grant extreme, partly because he's very humorless. I don't know whether he was like his own life, but Alan Moore, in that review of Against the Light, mentions that there's just, you know, there's no emotional response to incredibly weird stuff happening to people. They just sort of, here is this tentacle monster appearing out of the darkness. Oh, and then you go on to the next bit. Most people would have a panic attack at that point. I certainly would. I mean, I've freaked out at far less threatening things than that. And I can see, though, on the other hand, that if you are not prepared to make the further journey, then, of course, you are placing a limit not on just yourself, but since this whole tradition we have is a chain, teacher to student who becomes the teacher who and the students and so on and so on, there's a failure of obligation if you're not willing to say, I need to go as far as I can in this life, and to tell other people, if I've not done this work, maybe you can do the work I couldn't complete myself. I think there's a strong obligation in that. Mm-hmm. So, Neshama wakes up, really, in Binah. It's been sending messages through dreams, occasional fantasies, occasional little messages that come as sudden images, sudden recognitions, or sudden words. That's going to become much more evident to people who actually attain to being fully conversant and with knowledge of the Holy Guardian Angel. But the full thing is where Neshama is brought in as complete a manner as can be experienced within the limited context of any human life. Brandt suggests in The Ninth Side of Eden, which is where he says a lot about Darth, that the Black Brothers are those who view the universe as an objective reality. And I think the big message of Darth is, you know, what you know is so. This is, of course, what threw Crowley completely after he had actually done that 10th Aether experience and then rounded out his Enochian invocations in the next 10 or 12 days in the desert in North Africa. And then, of course, had to just cope with all the stuff that had been downloaded into him and process it over a considerable period of time. So the thing is that the ideal is the real, and the conventional, the known, is the illusory. That is the flip around that happens as somebody passes through Darth. And there is a very strenuous effort needed by people to equilibrate all of this. Now, most of these talks we're doing here, we're assuming that people who listen to what we come up with, you know, are fairly beginnerish on the scale of things. I know I'm talking at the limit of that because I'm talking at the limit of my own understanding, which is nowhere near where I feel it should be after almost 30 years in this game. But so many people get the fascination, the glamour of the Darth, the Abyss experience, because it is this very intense, exhausting, demanding, life-disrupting thing that happens to a very, very few people. And I think if we've done anything today to kind of strip some of that glamour off and point out just how difficult it is, then, you know, a talk like this is worth doing. Mm-hmm. The other thing, of course, is not making the Frater Achad error of, here I am, a neophyte, I can just leap over the abyss in one mighty bound. Quite possibly, he didn't really go very far. He just had a very profound experience of the path of Tav. I don't know. I'm not Frater Achad, but he seemed to be an oddball in it all and not to do particularly well after he and Crowley broke off relations. The key thing, though, is if you're going to be looking at Darth, you have to have completed all of those preceding Sephiroth quite methodically and exhaustingly, so that you've actually experienced the bits of you. Because in the abyss, people have to give up all their attachments, all the things that they know. And if you haven't explored all the bits of yourself, you're dragging more than you can imagine there.
So you really got to have those buttons sewn on, as Crowley
put it. No, they have to be self-releasing buttons. There are no buttons in the abyss. Be buttonless. You become this little pile of ash, as Crowley says. I mean, that's a marvelous metaphor. It's just everything has fallen apart, supposedly. Anything that you identified as a personal self is supposedly seen to be just... It wasn't nothing exactly, but it's nothing of any significance. And if you're still hanging on to ambition, and you're still hanging on to hope, and you're still hanging on to desires and all the other attachments, you would come to enormous grief by stepping into this so-called abyss. Mm-hmm. Because the abyss is kind of a metaphor for a complete shift of consciousness. Something occurred to me one day that there isn't an abyss there. It's just as thin as a piece of paper or one of those clear plastic films they, you know, wrap cheese or deli goods in. But it is such a profound move that it seems to be incredibly stretched out for people. Mm. So always look at this stuff with a warning. Understand that it's up there. Yes, it would be very cool to do this one day. But don't be freaked out if you don't actually get close enough to do this, because you would really need to be at the point where you could say, okay, I have to cross now. I've done my Hasidic homework. I've remembered every crucial thing about my life, which means not just autobiographical details, but also a comprehension of all the autobiographical details. Why did this happen? Why did I think this for 40 years? Why did I do that? Why did I always disparage myself or put myself down when this was simply something that I had to go through in order to understand why I was going through it? The marvelous paradoxes that have to come up, but until people have actually begun to reconcile that stuff with themselves, then a realistic approach to death is just not going to happen. Anyway, I've already stated more than I actually know from experience in this talk. I should probably shut it off.
Well, getting too obsessed with knowledge is probably the problem, I guess. And that might have been one of Echad's problems.
Yeah, I mean, one image I had one time of Darth, and it took me a while to figure out it was Darth, it was this enormous library, this vast, almost spherical library. And I thought, it's not just the library of humanity, it might have been that as well, but everything I've ever read, every dumb opinion I got off a TV series or a science fiction novel. Mm-hmm. Again, that's Kenneth Grant's genius. He just took Lovecraft because he thought, you know, it's all part of what we know, what we experience, what we're about. You know, it's all there. It's knowledge in various types. Incomplete knowledge, partial knowledge, half understood knowledge, half remembered knowledge, but it's all there, all of these things, all of which, you know, intermesh in various ways. There's probably a bunch of key tendencies in the human psyche that need to be released in order for people actually to make the journey without too much risk.
Well, you know, I think it's a natural function of the brain to use knowledge in order to create like a framework, like a conception for the mind, in order that we can function and feel happy about having some sense of control over our environment and that sort of thing. And just the fact of when you encounter all the knowledge and then and are confronted with the fact that it doesn't all add up, it doesn't actually all connect into a cohesive whole, it becomes fragmented no matter what way you approach it, then that's where it's like that what's beyond it becomes that maddening Cthulhu-like kind of malevolence, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That actually makes sense.
Is the mind. Yeah, the Cthulhu, I suspect, is the mind being boggled. It's the ultimate boggledom. You can't understand something, it seems too much. As I said earlier, I think there's easier ways of doing this through the established Tibetan or Hindu Advaita Vedanta stuff. But I mean, if you look at the Tibetan traditions, there's all these hideous, wrathful deities. There they are. They're in union with their, you know, consort. They're drinking the blood out of the skull, and they've got this face with fangs coming out, and there's all kinds of dark stuff. It's not really substantially different from what Lovecraft was writing about. Mm-hmm. There's another thing, though, that I'd forgotten, and it was something that I got out of Alan Moore's review of Against the Light. Yeah, this is a quote. If we are to speak of magic as the art, should we not also speak of art as magic? Even Crowley tellingly and rather poignantly describes great artists as superior to great magicians. Crowley also points out the connection that exists between a grimoire and a grammar, between casting spells and spelling, goes so far as to admit at one point that the greater part of magical activity lies in simply writing about it. Clearly, there is a reason why Hermes and Thoth, the gods of magic, should be simultaneously the gods of writing. I thought that was really an insightful idea, that Selim is one of the most verbal spiritual traditions ever. I was talking to a friend of mine who is a former Chogyam Trungpa student, and I said, do you find the Tibetan spiritual writings pretty tedious? He said, oh, Lord, yes. They follow a particular pattern. There's not much poetic quality to them, whereas Crowley is overflowing with symbolic poetry. Grant is producing a different kind of poetry based on pulp fiction. It's all part of the same thing, he says. I get his point, but really you can only approach what he's saying if you've already had a certain sense of exaltation through the Kabbalistic work you're doing. I think that's true also of other people who write about Thelema. We value them because they're concise, they're clear, but they are evocative. They produce a sense that there's something meaningful, there's something uplifting, and there's something that carries you forward here. Mm-hmm. That, of course, all that language is what jams up in Duff, and the language is finally what has to give way, because mental structures are so tied up, especially for us Westerners. I don't know how it works in the same way for people with cultures with a different spiritual heritage. But when you actually would hit Darth, suddenly this vast superstructure of language, ideas, podcasts like this one, all of it is just like it's completely unstable and has to collapse at a certain point. That, to me, would be a terrifying and catastrophic experience at the same time that I would, if I can just hang on to one sort of concentrated attention to it all as opposed to running screaming. One of these incarnations, I might actually make it through the experience of Darth and make it over the abyss.
Yeah, I guess information without focus is noise. It's kind of a nice, simple way of putting it, I think.
Yes, very much so.
But, on that note, don't go, I was going to say, don't go out there, oh gentle listener, looking for madness. But you know what? We're magicians, and that's what we do. That's kind of part of the part of the agenda here, in a sense. But it's doing it with some level of control and intention, rather than losing yourself to the madness.
Yeah, I think it's Liber Samek that says, first of all, attach more firmly to the higher. Like, get that knowledge and conversation thing there. So when you go astray, it's like, okay, I've messed up, but I know where the center point is that I can come back to. Mm-hmm. Grant, I think, thinks, no, that's deceptive. Let's just go into all of this dark stuff, because really it's just mental dreck on top of the fact that everything in the universe is ultimately empty. Ask a Buddhist, ask a Vedantist, ask me. And I think, yeah, but I need to be prepared for that, Kenneth, and I don't know whether I could ever actually follow your work, however much I can admire.
Yeah, and it's different for different people, right? Like, each of us has our own, you or I sitting here discussing this are going to ipso facto be approaching this with some degree of caution and preparation, whereas there's plenty of people that I meet in the community all the time who just kind of blunder into things without too much forethought and that sort of thing, which is fine, but it doesn't mean that we should both be looking at getting into the same things. If they're getting into something, kind of jumping on in, and it's something that's not going to be, completely destructive to them, then, it may not be so harmful. But if they're doing that with, going out in the woods to live and be a survivalist, and you have no background or understanding of what it is to be a survivalist, and just assuming that you can pick berries and live off of it, then you're in for a shock once winter comes.
And the bears show up.
Yes. Yeah.
At that point, you become the berries. Kind of creepy. But you at least need to know that the other stuff is there. And if you feel that at a certain point you need to explore stuff that looks really weird to you early in your magical career, do keep silence about it, because people won't understand what you're doing. And secondly, know that you've got your skill set. You've got your magical toolbox to say, okay, this is how I can set the parameters around my actual Kabbalistic temple. This is how I can isolate a specific energy or set of symbols or state of consciousness that I can explore. And if it goes a little wonky, I know what to do to get myself back in line with myself. I mean, we all have this. It's one of the big educational aspects of magic. Fucking up. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever became a good magician or just a good Kabbalist in general, whether they're a magical, theurgic Kabbalist or just simply a student of it. You need to make a mess of things and go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was really what struck Crowley after that whole North African adventure. It's like nothing that I've done before quite prepared me for this level of understanding, which goes beyond what I can really put together. Mm-hmm. He was able to complete the invocations of all 30 atheists in the next few days, and just to, you know, okay, I've done the set, and then, okay, journey's over, we've finished crossing the desert, Victor and I, and we've got to go back and just take advantage of civilization and its food supplies and warm, dry beds. Interesting thing to study. I think it's a moving account, Vision and the Voice, which is where he recounts all of this. Very disturbing, but fascinating all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll leave you with one other thought. I was trying to think, where is there a parallel to the Vision and the Voice that I've come across? And something occurred to me. I have a copy of Carl Jung's Liber Novus, the big red book. They did this some full-size reproduction of it about 12 years ago. My son bought me a copy. And I realized it's the same thing. Jung is going into the darker stuff of his own psyche. Story after story where he encounters mythical and legendary characters. I mean, this is exactly equivalent to his version of, you know, Lovecraftiana, you know, Yog Sothoth and all of those friendly guys. He has the equivalent with Siegfried dying and a whole load of people that I can't think of right off the top. But there's Sumerian figures, there's Greco-Egyptian figures. And it's a very, very hard book to read. I've done it three times and never finished it at one read through. After about a week, it's like I'm exhausted by the fact that there's no resolution to these things. He's just getting more and more information and getting more and more lost. If he hadn't had his girlfriend, because he was married to Emma Jung, Antonia Wolf there to keep him grounded, he said himself, I'd have completely lost it. And the worst part of his experience with downloading all of that stuff was when Antonia Wolf herself got so caught up in this with him that she lost her objectivity about what was happening. That's a story that has not yet been told. The Jung family have kept the chapter about Antonia that should be in Memories, Dreams, Reflections somewhere in a bank vault in Zurich. And thinking of Grant, I want to read a biography of Steffi Grant, his wife. There's a little bit about it in the book that Henrik Bogdan edited, Servants of the Star and the Snake. It's essays in honor of Kenneth and Steffi Grant that came out about 7 years ago, I think.
Mm.
But she's still a very little understood person. But anyone who could have spent 60 years as Kenneth Grant's magical partner must have been quite an extraordinary person, mm-hmm. and must have encouraged him to go to places where I ain't going and not many people will go. The person I think we need to hear more from is Manon Hedenborg-White, who has a contribution about women in the Typhonian tradition in that book. She's a very cogent thinker. She's a woman with a will. She's really on top of things, not afraid to go into unsafe areas that I'm sure annoy a lot of people who want her to go on about patriarchy and oppression when she's saying, well, how about we just empower ourselves and get some liberation moving?
Mm-hmm.
But it is a good book. It was expensive too. I think I paid $120 or something, but I just thought at some point I need to get into Grant, and I'm not sure I'm going to go through 9 novels to find out what it was all about.
Yeah.
Explaining what happened, explaining a little bit more about his life. I think that was some...
That does sound like, yeah, it'd be an interesting angle in. I had been gifted years ago a copy of The Hidden God, Aleister Crowley and the Hidden God, and I read through some of it and got really bored and just put it away, and I never returned to it. So I kind of passed him off as being just kind of, you know, not the same as, but equivalent to Israel Regardie in my kind of like dislike, in the sense that it's just kind of like overly verbose and going, you know, on and on and on, and what could have been said in just a simple paragraph or something.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, 9 novels, 3 trilogies. I mean, come on. You know, if you've got something to say, put it into one good novel. Maybe there's a sequel. I mean, I read the Wolf Hall historical series by Hilary Mantel, which is really good. But in the 3rd novel of that, she kind of faltered. She got won the Booker Prize for the first 2. And the 3rd one, it was just like, it didn't quite top things. So going on to 3 trilogies, yeah, too much. But he was a figure that you can't just walk around. That was Alan Moore's point. We've all got his books on our bookshelves. What is it about the guy? Mm-hmm. And the marvelous line he has about, it's like that these people have created a brimstone-tinged aftershave and, you know, splashed it all over themselves as well as down their underpants. I mean, it was just... Each chapter an emetic gush of curdling chthonic biles and juices served up steaming, a hot shrapnel of ideas, intense and indiscriminate, a shotgun full of snails and amethysts discharged point blank into the reader's face.
Couldn't be better said if it was coming from the jaws of Karanzon himself.
Yes. Wonderful piece of prose, that classic stuff.
That's great. Yeah, Kenneth Grant. That's one of those people who's kind of polarizing. Either really like him or really don't, it seems like, for most people. But it's nice to get kind of, you know, a little bit less extreme, I think, and be able to take it for some of the value that it brings to the table.
Well, I was told all through my years of early work in Kabbalistic stuff, avoid Grant, he's really bad, dangerous, he turned himself into a human sewer. That book of essays, it was a limited printing of 1,000 copies, Servants of the Star and the Snake. I developed a better understanding of what it was he was trying to do. I still don't think I want to do what he's done, but reading him, I began to understand his point, and that inevitably influenced a lot of the ways that I was maintaining strict categories for myself about good and bad. Grant helps break down that stuff in a good way, provided you've done enough reading of Crowley beforehand to understand what Crowley says are the dangers of going off the main track before you're ready.
Yeah, I think getting, reading these different sources, Crowley, Grant, maybe Samachad, and some of these other things, I do think it's worth reading all these things because you get a better triangulation of the subject, regardless, you know, rather than just choosing one dog to back.
Yeah, you need to triangulate. It's a very good term. First of all, learn the system, go through those first 4 Sephiroth in any decent mystery school. Or if you're incredibly self-disciplined, you could do that on your own. Some people have done it successfully. I'm not sure whether many people really have a great deal of success, and you're much more liable to get stuck in self-deception if you're working on your own. That is the thing that would always bother me. I've never been able to be away from a group just so that I've got some, you know, a parent figure there to say, hey, I think I might be in a strange place. Could you advise me what I should do? And usually the advice is, yes, you're in a strange place, just continue. But you need somebody to say that to you so you can find your own way through. Kalima is a community. It's not just solitary individuals. Because eventually, if you do come into the realm of Da'at or its outer surroundings, you're absolutely on your own. There isn't anything there. Even the Holy Guardian Angel itself disappears. It just is not, so we read, it's just not evident in any way at all. All you have is your own awareness of things and some sort of residual bit of will that would take you through. So you need to do an awful lot of preparatory work. And if that takes more than one lifetime, then so be it.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a really fascinating subject to get into. And I wish you all the best. I hope you get all the rain you can handle without flooding.
Oh, yes, we have as much as we can handle. My shoes are wet at the moment, but we were having a drought here in Mexico, so it was a good thing to receive. Anyway, it was fun doing this one with you. I hope it's of use to somebody out there. I certainly learned a bit more about Da'at simply by going through everybody's opinion and thinking, ooh, it's all different for everybody.
Well, thank you very much again, and 93.
93.
Listening. Look for Toronto Kalima on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Watch for events in the city. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes.